Mr. Vanderschaft, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Scott Vanderschaft. I'm the Washington County Attorney. Reading from the Code of Judicial Ethics preamble, an independent, fair, and impartial judiciary is indispensable to our system of justice. That is what we are here to deal with today, in my opinion, and the cornerstone of what I'll be talking about regarding the recusal motion that was filed by myself, as well as the motion for joinder that was filed on behalf of this case. To give you some procedural indications of how this case went and how we got to be where we were, this matter was charged, two juveniles were charged as adults. They had a preliminary hearing, at least one of them did, went upstairs to district court. At the district court level, there was a motion to transfer that was done. Evidence was presented, and the judge denied the original transfer. At some point in time later, there was a motion to suppress as well as a motion to reconsider the original motion to transfer. When we showed up for the motion to suppress, we were informed by the court that since everybody was there, we might as well do it, although the issue of transfer had not been decided. There was a discussion between myself, Mr. Wirth, and the court. It is not in the record before you because that jurisdictionally is done, where we tried to inquire as to what would be the point of doing the hearing as well as any controlling value that an order like that might have. There was a general consensus, and I won't speak for Mr. Wirth, at least my opinion was a general consensus that that order, should the court transfer this down to juvenile court, would not have or hold any water, so to speak. We went ahead and had that hearing, and then we received later on, simultaneously, a motion that sustained the motion to suppress. An order sustaining the motion to suppress and an order transferring the case down to juvenile court. Once we got down to juvenile court, there was another motion that was filed by the defense in regards to a motion to suppress. I had two staff people that originally were handling that case in juvenile court. When that matter was going to be heard, my staff people came over, two deputies that were with my office, and indicated that there was an issue with the court, that they needed my assistance. I went over to the court and spoke to the judge about what was going on. Part of what you have, which was the record, was my affidavit of some of those conversations. In off-record conversations with the court indicated to me that it had read the prior ruling of the district court, that it was going to follow that ruling, and that it knew the law, and it would abide by it.
Is that in dispute?
I'm sorry?
Is that in dispute?
Which
what the judge said to you off the record?
What the judge said to me off the record? From having the hearing that we had later on, the judge believes that I have a misrepresentation or at least some kind of factual difference between what I believe was said and what he indicates that he said, yes.
You had an affidavit reciting what you said at
Correct.
The recusal hearing when the other side was, the other counsel was questioned by the judge on the record.
He was.
And gave a different version.
I wouldn't say it was a different version. If you look at the testimony, the question was, or there were two, the judge said there was one. Question one, weren't you in the room when this took place? Yes. Question number two, is that what I said? And the answer was, well, I don't believe it was said verbatim. So I don't know that that is a disagreement with what I remember when it was said, and I can certainly understand the difficult position a defense attorney is put in when they are called as a witness for the judge and asked a question of what is it you remember or don't remember. And so I don't know that a defense attorney or any witness for that matter saying that I don't remember verbatim is a disagreement with what I had heard or what I put in my affidavit. And the things that were put in my affidavit were things that I had actually encountered. They were not things that were told to me, they were things that I knew, which is why I put them in there. I certainly wasn't going to put anybody else, this is my motion, it was something I was going to stand on. Bringing up, yeah.
Assuming your affidavit correctly sets forth what occurred, why is what the judge said problematic?
What the judge had indicated to me was that he was not going to allow us to have a hearing. He didn't see the point of it. He told us we were not going to be able to put on evidence. He indicated he would follow whatever the district court had said and what he knew the law. And what he had said was, unless you have new evidence.
But did he believe he was bound by the district court's decision?
I don't believe that he thought that originally, and I think this is kind of a red herring that goes through these proceedings. I was always told jurisdiction was like a balloon with air in it, that once the jurisdiction's gone, all the air's gone. And we tried to have that discussion in regards to what that order was. Now, later on at the actual evidentiary hearing, he had us brief that issue, which was difficult because I didn't understand why we were briefing it. One, we had, at least upstairs in district court, had an understanding that it wouldn't be controlling.
Is that you had an order from a district court saying a statement should be suppressed?
I did.
And how is that potentially not binding on the trial judge?
Because I had an order that divested the district court with jurisdiction. And so
isn't there a real dispute on whether that's a binding order that's raised judicata, a claim issue or an issue preclusion or things of that nature?
I might agree with you if there was jurisdiction, but there wasn't jurisdiction from the district court. When it divested itself that it had done.
When it made the decision, did it have jurisdiction?
I'm sorry?
When it made the decision, did it have jurisdiction?
At the time that it made it, and then it divested it right after it made that decision.
So it had jurisdiction and made a decision.
And if the case had stayed up in district court, I'd agree that that ruling would have been not only binding on the district court and on me.
You had a court that had jurisdiction that made a decision on an issue.
Correct.
Okay. So why is that potentially not a binding order?
Because that same court then divested itself of jurisdiction and gave it to the juvenile court.
Which is after the fact of making the decision.
Sure, but that decision wouldn't hold any water. It wouldn't mean anything because that court no longer would continue to have that case. And it didn't just say, hey, I'm not having the case. It divested itself of jurisdiction.
I think the question is the decision made at the district court when it had jurisdiction, the law of the case?
It would have benefited state and district court.
How did the juvenile court judge eventually decide the motion to suppress?
The juvenile court judge eventually decided to overrule the motion to suppress.
So
essentially in our favor.
So he didn't follow the district court's order?
Ultimately, no. But that was not until we had the motion.
So you ultimately got the ruling you're asking for, so how can we find bias or partiality?
Well, I think for two reasons. One, State versus Lauder says that you shouldn't watch improper judicial conduct gamble on a favorable ruling as to that conduct and then complain or get when you guessed wrong. I'm not here to say it ultimately did the judge do that, but in the context of why. Here we had off-the-court statement or off-the-record statements from the judge in regards to what he was and wasn't going to do. We then had a judge call the defendant's attorney, a party proponent, as his witness. He asked him one question.
Isn't he allowed to call witnesses?
Sure, what's the definition of a witness? And you have to do so sparingly according to even 614, which I'll tell you at the time I wasn't aware of. And even counsel for the defendant wasn't aware of it if you look at the record and the way the transcript went. But the case law says you do so sparingly. And you do show with impartiality. And what I might say would be that there were two other witnesses that should have been called. The two deputies of the court, at least Judge Samuelson and the defense attorney, claim I wasn't around for a lot of the conversation. Well, there were two witnesses that were either in that courtroom or in the courthouse that would have been available.
Did you ask to call them?
I didn't know that he was going to call his own, and no, I did not.
So after he called the defense counsel, did you ask?
But he called that witness.
Did you ask permission to cross-examine that witness?
I don't believe that I was given time. If you look at the record, immediately after asking the question, Judge essentially goes through a lineage with me.
So you didn't stop and say, Judge, I'd like to question.
I did not. But I think the fact that...
Judge, I'd like to call other witnesses to rebut what defense counsel said?
No, because I stood on my affidavit at the time, which was, I believe, enough. I believe the actions of the court after that, at that recusal hearing, by calling the defense's attorney and didn't excuse the attorney, allows him to sit back down with the defendant and then proceed with the case. Whether I won a motion to suppress or ultimately the defendant in this case was found not guilty or not adjudicated is irrelevant to me.
But isn't that some indication that the judge could be fair if, despite all this happening, he ultimately ruled in your favor?
If that's the measure you want to use, then I guess you could. I don't. The fact that there was bias there, and then later to make a ruling, well, say, well, I rule in favor of you, I'm not biased anymore.
What was the bias?
The bias was the fact that he was predisposed before we even got to the
motion. So you thought he was bound by the district court's order. That was the bias?
That was not the bias. Because at the time that we initiated that conversation, when I offered my affidavit, there wasn't any discussion in regards to being bound by a ruling of district court. That came through conversation later. And again, that to me is a red herring, because I don't believe there was anyone who thought that there was going to be a binding order on him. He had not heard any evidence. Everything was new.
Before you sit down,
yes.
You've argued an error to failure to grant joinder.
Correct.
Is there any provision in the juvenile code that allows joinder, that provides for joinder?
I think you have to look at it as quasi-criminal, and I think you have to look at what went on in this scenario.
So the short answer to my question is no.
That is correct.
And very well, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you.
I have one more.
Sure.
What would be the outcome, if indeed there can be such an outcome, of this court saying, Judge, you should have joined these? I mean, is there any opportunity for an appellate court to do that, even in a criminal case? What's the remedy? I mean, what are you after?
Well, the reason on the joinder here is essentially the fact that you had two defendants involved in the exact same activity. They're co-defendants, it's a lie. What happens in this case is because we have one trial, judge doesn't just say, I don't adjudicate him. He actually comes out with a ruling and questions the credibility of our defendant. How can I possibly now, with the other co-defendant that is still out there and still has a case that's going on, how can I possibly perceive that the court isn't biased now anyways, because they specifically ruled as to one? Why not have done both of them? Because if he was going to go ahead and say that the victim in this case was incredible, one, don't say it at all, just say there's no adjudication or not guilty. Or if you were going to say that, that's exactly why we had asked for the joiner. Because we had a victim who would then have to testify twice. We had two people that were involved in the exact same activity at the exact same time. And that's what we were trying to avoid, was putting our victim through the multiple testimonies between two defense attorneys, which was something that we believed would make sense given the fact that this was a sexual assault case.
Was J.K. placed in jeopardy?
Yes.
And jeopardy terminated when the petition was dismissed?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wolf, good morning to you.
Morning, may I please the court? I'm Nicholas Wolf, attorney for J.K., minor child, here for discussing. The state's brief assigned three separate areas of it believed were basis for recusal. I'm going to start with the last one. It wasn't discussed here in our argument, but that was based on comments or what transpired at the actual recusal hearing. And I would say, strictly speaking, and that's what we're here for, those issues were never actually before the court to consider at the trial court level whether he should recuse himself. So I believe the correct procedural path for the county attorney would have been to file another motion to recuse and have those issues placed before the court. So I don't think the court should consider what transpired at the actual recusal hearing, because that was not ever an issue. And as we know, recusal issues are the sound discretion of the trial court to determine. Let me go back to the very first issue, which was some comments the court made while it was sitting as a county court and at a preliminary hearing. Those comments, I don't believe, were prejudicial at all. They were, in fact, I think, the definition of judicial, which were explaining the rulings of why he was binding the case over to the district court. And I think what
comments that any judge would make or could make.
Correct. They're comments that I think are expected to be made, explanations of the ruling
during the proceeding, at the time of the proceeding,
by the record, in open court,
present in front of both parties.
Correct. It was in the transcript of the proceeding, on the record. That being said, I'd also like to point out, he bound the case over. I don't necessarily agree with that result, but he bound the case over. Again, a formal ruling in favor of the state's request. We get up to the district court, and I won't spend too much time on that, because there was a record of that before this court. And it's transferred back. And I think the only thing we can consider part of the record was that there was a district court order. And county attorney is absolutely correct. There was a discussion at the time in district court as to the binding effect. I didn't believe it would be binding. We have discussions with our juvenile court judge now. And those discussions absolutely were involved around whether or not that was binding. There were certainly some inquiry as to whether the evidence changed or the theories of the defense for the suppressed motion changed at all. That being said, there was no bias. There was no refusal to have a hearing. We had the hearing. There was no bias in how he looked at the issues. He didn't go with it. He didn't follow the district court order. I believe both of those were in error, by the way. I believe that the court, I know the court has actually briefed the issue of the binding effect of the district court order, and I believe it was, there was collateral estoppel that would have applied because it was the exact same issues, the exact same parties, and the exact same suppressed motion, essentially. I think I carried it down a little bit with the ultimate ruling.
Did the district court judge transfer the case to juvenile court immediately after the suppression hearing?
No, they were separate issues. They were kind of leapfrogging each other. The motion was on file. There was a motion to reconsider on file at the time of the suppression hearing. I think the suppression order came out in March, and then they were transferred in late May based on another evidentiary hearing that happened on the transfer issue. So I think the real question is, well, we don't know what the judge's intent was. We don't have a record of what the comments were. We have the county attorney's affidavit, certainly, but I think the court on its own, on the record, stated he didn't agree with that, and those were his statements attributed to him. I think his statements are certainly an indication of what he believed he said.
Of course, the judge can't testify.
Correct. He did not testify. I'm not submitting those evidence. I'm just submitting that we know that the court did not find the affidavit to be credible, so to speak, in terms of its assessment of the evidence. And the attorney indicates, you know, we don't gamble. I'd also like to point out these statements that he made as a preliminary court judge were in existence for years, and about 5 or 6 months transpired after the juvenile petition was filed before they were ever raised as a basis for a claim. So I think we do have some after-the-fact arguments being made, because certainly that request for recusal, there truly was bias in those preliminary hearing arguments, could have been done prior to late November, and were tacked on after the conversation and the motion was suppressed.
What is your understanding of what the county attorney ultimately wants?
Well, I think it's another way of the evidence, right? I mean, that's the only one. Why are we here? The ultimate issue is to be communications with the appeal, is to weigh the evidence or anything else. I think the belief is, and I don't believe it's clear in the brief, that should this court find that this trial judge should have recused himself way back in November of last year, 2 years ago, then we have to remand back to that point. It's not my request, but I believe that's the remedy that's there, because if he should have recused himself, then a new judge should have been appointed from that point on.
So then the question of jeopardy comes up, does it not?
Absolutely. I think that really, and this goes to the joint argument, while there is certainly no provision for it in the juvenile code, and if you look at, I'm just going to jump straight into it, the State v. Stranger case, there, I believe there was a request to actually join an actual criminal action with a violation of probation, and this court found that that was inappropriate because that wasn't provided for under the criminal joinder code. So when you're talking about joining two non-criminal cases and applying a criminal statute to do so, I don't think that analysis is fair or valid. That being said, the juvenile court didn't call into question this witness's credibility. He made a judicial determination that she was not credible. Completely different. There is no anticipated different result. It doesn't matter if it's this judge or another judge that is going to change the fact that this witness gave materially false or inaccurate contradicting statements under oath, not only under oath at the trial, under oath at depositions, multiple that transpired. So the remedy to me is not clear, because there was jeopardy. He was given his day in court, the adjudication. There was other evidence, despite the contradictory statements of the victim that tended to indicate these allegations could not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The court should, I believe, find that this matter is adjudicated, that jeopardy has attached, that even if there was error as to the recusal or, frankly, even the joinder, that there is no remedy available to, well, depending on what the remedy requested is, if it is to re-adjudicate, that is proper. Any more questions?
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal?
No, there is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the next case of the day.